The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show on this Feedback Monday evening. It's brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Thank you, Mdu. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Feedback is the thing where your voice repeats in your ears, and it's very distracting, but it's stopped now, which is a relief. It's very nice to be back with you. I've had a wonderful holiday. Thank you for asking. And thank you for the team for keeping the home fires burning. A couple of stories from my experiences, which I will share with you a little later. The 7 o'clock half hour, as we call it, between 7 and 5:30, I want to talk about two countries that have come from, one from nowhere, and has had this most astonishing stratospheric rise in prosperity, and another that came from a deep, dark fascist past that, when the fascist finally was finished, finally died, it made some very big and important strategic choices. And to travel around that country today, you would have absolutely no idea of its really fractured, complicated history. Really, really difficult. And so as a result of that, the smart decisions that they've made, the strategies that they've employed, they've got enormous and wonderful infrastructure that serves their country, serves their people, generates the income, that pays the taxes, that allows the services to be delivered to those that need them. It's two very inspiring stories and two different takes for you this evening. One out of a book and one out of personal experience. We'll talk about Capitec's big win against SARS today. SARS, I think, admitting defeat in this particular battle, but saying that it's not all over. The fat lady has not yet sung. And so it is the one that we are going to be doing in some detail this evening. Also, our How I Make Money guest this evening, we are going to be talking to a man who sells secondhand watches. Secondhand watches is a lifestyle choice that he has made and is able, therefore, to make a living from that. And also this evening, to tell you that oil prices, yes, they have come off, as you heard in Eyewitness News from Heady Heights over the weekend. $90 a barrel this evening, very close to it. Stock market's a bit twitchy, but a risk of an escalation of the Israel invasion of Gaza, the growing possibility following Iran's decision to dispatch drones over the weekend, looking to attack Israel. The messaging quite ragged and full of misinterpretation and misinformation. So there's a fair amount of caution in markets around the world, although that caution has been put aside later on in the afternoon session, as the markets have anticipated that perhaps this is just a response, particularly to the attack in Damascus of the Iranian embassy there, where several Iranian commanders were killed, and things will calm down once again. We'll look at that in some detail this evening. It does mean that, however, some practical restrictions in that region and end-to-air traffic for the time being, severe disruptions, some carriers looking to resume as quickly as they can. However, there are the more cautious airlines postponing it until at least the weekend, until tensions cool. I do see lots of commentary around our latest bout of currency jitters, linking that on social media to politics and to politicians and to what could and could not happen and what might happen and what the polls say and what the polls don't say and what the people are fighting about the polls about. In reality, it's got more to do with the fact that inflation that's supposed to be a lot more predictable by now is anything but predictable, and therefore interest rates remain higher in the US for longer, blah, blah. Same old story, different day. It's all about American cost of capital.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Big tax victory today over a relatively small amount of money for Capitec. More on that story in just a moment. But first, broadcast rights for sporting events, especially the big global sporting events, things like the Premier League and the Olympics and the Rugby World Cup and football and FIFA, all of those have led to a revolution in broadcasting, a revolution in sponsorship and a revolution in players' wages in recent decades. It's been good for an industry. But if you're somebody without access to cable or satellite TV, you will feel left out. And there's been a long-running battle between the free-to-air players who say, hold on a second, but this isn't free to this isn't fair to everybody, when a monopoly, relatively, like MultiChoice, is able to dominate the sector. Duncan McLeod is the founder and editor at Tech Central. A competition tribunal has given e-media a bit of relief when it comes to its long-running fight with MultiChoice over what they call sub-licensed sports on its Open View channel. Now, please explain the technicalities of this to me, Duncan. It's an important battle. It's an important fight for those who don't have access to MultiChoice.
Yes, good evening, Bruce. This goes back to the Rugby World Cup last year when the when MultiChoice at the last moment decided to sub-license rights to various World Cup games to the SABC. Now, the SABC channels are carried on this platform called OpenView, which is owned by eMedia, which is the same company that owns EMCA, the television news channel, as well as ETV and various other assets. And MultiChoice specifically told the SABC in the sub-licensing agreement that they may not carry the Rugby World Cup games on OpenView, the eMedia platform, that they may only carry it on their free-to-air terrestrial channels. So other platforms, including OpenView, were excluded in terms of the sub-licensing agreement that the two parties signed. eMedia took umbrage at this, clearly because they wanted to be able to broadcast the Rugby World Cup games, and took the matter to the High Court, where they were dismissed by a High Court judge and told to go away, basically. They were told it wasn't urgent. They then withdrew their they withdrew the application to the High Court, and they went to straight to the Competition Commission and lodged a complaint there. And at the same time, or subsequent to that, they went to the Competition Tribunal seeking an urgent decision to prevent MultiChoice from continuing with these rules around sub-licensing. And today's judgment, if I can call it that, out of the Competition Tribunal was a result of that complaint, and the tribunal has found in eMedia's favour and said for the next 6 months, MultiChoice must actually provide these sub-licensed sports rights on the OpenView platform. So it's a victory, an interim victory, if I can call it that, for eMedia in this ongoing battle.
But these sporting rights are massively expensive. This is a global industry. This is something for which MultiChoice pays a small fortune, and in fact a very big fortune, in order to secure the broadcast rights. It's what's made MultiChoice into the Pan-African giant it is. It is the reason why Canal Plus, the French company, wants MultiChoice, of course, because it's become a very attractive asset as a result. Does this not undermine its exclusivity in the market? And I wonder whether or not they couldn't, you know, complain that this in fact is anti-competitive, because they're the ones with the deep pockets who are able to afford these things, and if they have to provide them to competitors, well, they lose their competitive edge, surely.
Yeah, I mean, it's an emotive issue because you know, many people will argue that these are national sporting teams and they should be available on all platforms, not only pay television. But you're quite right that acquiring the rights for these games is exceptionally expensive, and that money is large to a large degree plowed back into the sporting federations. That actually does help the sports industry. So there's two arguments here. MultiChoice hasn't responded to today's decision by the tribunal specifically, but when they were arguing there back in January, they said that eMedia's true grievance, and I'm quoting here, is simply a commercial one, namely that the impugned restriction is preventing it from being able to free ride on super sports investments in sports rights. So, you know, there's two polarized positions here, and it's going to be interesting to see which way the Competition Commission eventually decides on this, because, you know, there are strong arguments on both sides. But if it's a purely a commercial discussion, then I would say that probably Supersport and MultiChoice are in the right here.
Duncan McLeod, thank you, the founder and editor at Tech Central, who demystifies some of the complexities of the world of technology, and that spans into broadcast from time to time as well. Duncan McLeod, thanks very much indeed.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Now, this next discussion falls very firmly into what we on the team call a red braces interview. These are interviews that are appreciated only by people who, if they don't wear red braces, they're very tempted to wear red braces to work. You know the type, those that sit in those stuffy corner offices that don't ever talk to anybody else unless it's to shout at them. Those kinds of people. And this is one of those kinds of interviews, but it is important enough, however, to draw your attention to it, because it may very well have far-reaching implications ultimately for South Africa's VAT regime. The short version is that Capitec has has given SARS a blood nose in the Constitutional Court to help navigate what is a regulation-riddled realm of highfalutin tax jargon. And is the tax executive at ENS Africa, the best interpreter of tax we know, Charles DeVet. And this all goes back to a fight that Capitec had related to some deductions a decade ago when it came to VAT, Charles.
Good evening, Bruce, and that's exactly what it's about. Is Capitec provided insurance cover on its loan to its customers without actually charging a premium in the circumstances? And the VAT Act allows that when you're an insurance company, you can claim the input tax on payouts on that amount. And Capitec claimed that amount, and SAR said no, and they ended up in the Constitutional Court.
And the Constitutional Court, I mean, these things go back and forth for a long time, but at the start, Capitec was making a claim related to the VAT issue, which SARS disallowed. Capitec dug in its heels, chose a fight. And I mean, the basis of this is banks lend money to us and to companies. Most of us will pay that money back on time with interest, but a couple of people don't. And it's widely accepted within the banking industry that you take a bit of risk on some people. If they pay you back, you win. They get the loans they need to advance their lives, and everybody's happy. When it goes wrong, however, you need to write off the loan as a bad debt. Where does VAT fit into this quite complicated picture?
So, I mean, the place where VAT comes into play is that on the fees that are charged on your account, there is always a VAT added to that amount. So, you know, if you look at any account that or loan that a bank advances, then, you know, there would be no VAT on the loan itself because that is a financial service. There would be no VAT on the interest that is charged on that loan, also because that's a financial service. But there would be VAT on the fees that are levied by the bank that end up as being due and payable to them.
Okay, so this is about the princely sum of 72 million rand, which to me and you is an awful lot of money. But I imagine the time and energy that it's taken to fight this fight has probably cost at least that over the last 8, 9, 10 years, for as long as this thing's been going on, Charles. Why is a fight over a technicality, over a relatively insignificant amount of money in the bigger corporate scheme, so important, not only possibly to Capitec, but potentially to others as well?
There were two reasons for that, mainly, Bruce. Is, you know, this 71.5 million rand related to one financial year. So, you know, that if we go back to 2013-14, you know, times 10, that would be, you know, 710 million rand that would be at stake in the circumstances. So that's what made the fight worthwhile. The second thing is that the Supreme Court of Appeal got a bit confused as to what the VAT principles were that were applicable, and misconstrued some of the principles, and that's why it was necessary to go to the Constitutional Court to get clarity on two very important aspects.
No, exactly. Very important. And SARS has acknowledged that importance. Whenever they lose a matter in the courts, they say, well, we are very grateful for the clarity because the court has now decided. What SARS has suggested this evening, though, in a statement that it's issued, is that this isn't necessarily universal. So I don't know whether or not there's been this massive victory for the entire banking sector, as we might have believed when the statement was first issued on Friday.
I think that's probably correct in the sense that, you know, Capitec, if we go back to the amounts, was claiming 71 million for that year, and SARS disallowed the full amount in the circumstances. The court has come back and said that they should apportion that amount, so they should allow somewhere between 8% and 12%. So, you know, let's say 10% of that amount. So they've said that, you know, Capitec is entitled to 7.5 million, or just over 7 million, and SARS must refund 7 million in the circumstances. Mm. So, you know, with a sports analogy, maybe it was close to a draw as far as that's concerned.
So is this any, I mean, does this significantly change the VAT world? Does it change VAT regimes? Does it change the way that banks generally will be able to apportion some of these costs? Will it ultimately make my banking a little cheaper, easier, simpler, faster, better, whatever the phrase is?
I think that it has clarified very important principles from a VAT perspective of the guy in the corner office in the red shirt or whatever the way that you explained it, in the sense that they are often sort of what technically is called supplies for no consideration. So that's when a supermarket gives you things, or you know, gives you five items, but you only pay for four. For example, I mean, they've clarified in these circumstances that, you know, when a bank gives you insurance cover without actually charging for it, in those instances, it is still a taxable supply. So the principles of the VAT Act are still apply in those circumstances. And, you know, the confusion introduced by the SEA is no longer applies is the first point that was critical from a way that I think all businesses deal with that on a go forward basis. The second point is it is around sort of apportionment. Now, you know, apportionment, or you know, sort of a mixed business that a bank is when they make taxable and exempt supplies. The VAT Act has got specific provisions associated with that, and now they've looked at the way that the VAT Act is laid out, and said that even if you're not, you know, technically in the apportionment section, you still have to apply apportionment. And I think that potentially could change the landscape for financial services institutions. I mean, both banks and life insurance companies, in the sense that the simplistic way that we apply apportionment may change going forward. So a single method may now become a multiple method and much more difficult to apply.
Okay. Thank you very much for that this evening. My thanks, as always, on issues of complicated tax and other unimpenetrable. Yes, unimpenetrable. What would that be? No, I can't even think of the word. I've been on holiday too long. Tax executive at ENS Africa, Charles De Wet, this evening, helping us through the morass of tax issues on that particular front.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
I'll tell you a little bit about Elon Musk's latest trials and travails. Not too much corporate news on the markets today. There was a deep sense of negativity, however, through the JSE. That was shaken off, it would seem, across European markets. And certainly as the US opened, things were looking a little bit more cheerful on that front this evening. Sibonise Nqomalo, who is the Chief Investment Officer at the Old Mutual Investment Group. Markets today, just explain them, please, in the context of weekend jitters and weekend worries, and possibly worries going into this week related to the trouble we've seen develop over the weekend in the Middle East.
Yes, Bruce, good evening to you and good evening to your listeners. Yes, if one is sitting on Friday and on the weekend and watching this, you would have thought, wow, I'm wondering how markets are going to take this news, because this was obviously weekend we saw Iran fire a barrage of various artillery into Israel. And this has never happened before. And so this is a massive step. Now, the trick which in terms of global markets here, Bruce, is that Iran is the seventh largest oil producer. And if we look at the third largest oil producer in the world is Russia. So now you've got Russia, which is at war, and their oil is banned from being used in the world, although, you know, that could be tested up by the market. Iran is now obviously also getting involved in some war. That's number seven. The trick with oil is that nobody has really invested in oil over the last few years, given the ESG concerns and the world transforming to green energy. But the demand hasn't changed materially. So the world is still consuming a lot of oil. And yet now you've got companies or countries that produce all of this oil that are now entangled in wars. And so therefore, there's a threat. That's why if you watch the news, you would have seen the minute those missiles were fired and those drones were fired, the Iranians themselves went straight to the petrol stations to fill up, because that is the fear. And the fear of oil is that actually inflation, which is already proving stickier and obviously putting a nice chokehold on the global economy, is actually going to stay higher. If inflation stays higher, we're all going to be poorer, companies are going to be poorer, markets are going to come down, and interest rates are not going to come down as the market anticipates. So that is where the dangers are, Bruce.
No, exactly right. And it is, I mean, in as much as, you know, we get very caught up in the moment and we fear World War III and we fear that it's all inevitable, investment markets are very quick to discount what they see as worry and then sudden certainty. It remains the big issue, just remains the United States, doesn't it? And higher interest rates for longer. This is the primary thing that is actually driving sentiment on markets. You know, the reality of what's driving things on markets.
Yes, Bruce, it definitely is. It is all about America. America is the biggest market in the world. And if you go back, now we've done the first 3 months of the year, the fourth quarter of the year. If you went back to the beginning of the year, the first quarter was very strong, largely driven by a strong U.S. economy. And the strong U.S. economy and the strong U.S. market was driven by this fact that the markets were looking forward and saying, hey, in 2024, the inflation is going to cool down to the 2% level that the Fed's targeting, and also interest rates are then going to come down. We're going to have several cuts, especially heading to the U.S. election. But here we are, Bruce. Last year, the U.S. printed 3.5% inflation numbers. So inflation is not coming down anywhere close to the Fed level, which is now threatening the fact that there'll be interest rate cuts. And the markets are asking themselves, ooh, have we been too enthusiastic here? And I think the answer is yes, Bruce. Because as we're starting to get data from companies, I mean, you mentioned something about Elon Musk opening. So Tesla is cutting 10% of its workforce globally. Okay, Tesla is one of the strong companies, a strong performer.
Yeah.
You've got Apple, they had the lowest sales since COVID. So they had 10% down in their sales because of their issues in terms of China and facing competition in China. So all of a sudden, you've got the strongest companies in the U.S., which form part of what's called the Magnificent Seven, the seven companies that have basically tech-related, that have carried the market. All of a sudden, Bruce, those fundamentals are not showing as bright. Interest rates are still as high. And the markets, Bruce, I think we should be worried here. I think we should be worried.
Well, I mean, you sent me a graph earlier today saying, look at this. And the gap in valuations, I don't want to get this absolutely right in terms of a description, but the gap between the valuations of emerging market equities, so markets like South Africa, probably China, India and others,
yeah,
versus the United States, the relative price is at its lowest level ever between emerging markets as a broad block and the United States, where we're seeing massive valuations, particularly on those Magnificent Seven. And in emerging markets, nobody wants to go near them, including our own. And we see these stupidly low valuations on some of our companies, and it's really hard to fathom. But I think what you're saying explains it, and that is the herd mentality goes, the U.S. is the only safe place on earth. And that's why we see this massive valuation of the dollar, massive valuation coming through in terms of shares on that market.
Exactly, Bruce. I mean, this particular chart that I showed you showing emerging market equities versus the U.S. is that the gap, 50 years, it hasn't been this low. So U.S. markets have very high expectations, are priced very high, and emerging markets, which is China, Russia, South Africa, India, Brazil, those are very low. And so, and the expectations therein are also very low. And so as an investor, investing when expectations are high has proven very unprofitable. But investing when expectations are low, Bruce, that tends to give you great returns. So it's time to invest in emerging markets.
That's a big call. Sibonise Nxumalo this evening, Chief Investment Officer at the Old Mutual Investment Group. Bring us to 6:30, this Eyewitness News, now brought to you by Khalix. Khalix for the businessman who knows what he wants. Here's Mikey Malapo.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, Simonizo mentioned it in our market report this evening, all about that guy from Pretoria. What's his name? Elon Musk, made extremely wealthy primarily as a result of the fact that he is the founder of what has been one of the most extraordinarily successful manufacturers of electric vehicles in the world. Well, the company that made him one of the richest people in the world is now cutting jobs. It's going to lay off 10% of its more than 140,000 strong global electric vehicle workforce. And Elon Musk saying there's nothing he hates more, but it has to be done for a lean, innovative and hungry, what he calls, business that is at the next growth phase cycle. That may be wishful thinking. Company is set to report quarterly earnings later on this month, but it has seen a huge decline in vehicle deliveries. And it was the first time, I think, in about 4 years. And it's not meeting market expectations, and we're seeing huge pressure come on Tesla. And there's going to be ongoing pressure because China, of course, is seeing a huge rise in far less expensive electric vehicles than those that are produced by Tesla. And Elon Musk so far has avoided going into and looking at cheaper alternatives to his very comfortable, very lovely, very quiet, very stealthy, very attractive, very nicely built Tesla models that he's released so far. But yeah, his lunch is sort of not necessarily being eaten at this stage, but certainly being nibbled on by players who are not interested in how he feels about laying off his staff. Yeah, 10% of Tesla's global workforce is having to find a new job.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
Well, one of the many great frustrations I think most of us share is our government does struggle to make some fairly obvious reforms, and reforms that would accelerate economic recovery. It would do the work that government constantly talks about as it finds itself stuck in what I see as an ideological cul-de-sac. And I've noted it often, and I'm sorry if you're sick of the quote, but it is a very good quote to haul out at times like this. And it's from the former UK ambassador to South Africa, Lord Robin Rennick, who says the ANC is addicted to state-run everything. And we've seen it in almost every aspect of the state-owned enterprise sector, where there's been massive failure, and only at the last minute has government opened up the doors to allow the private sector to come in. I wonder how complicated it would be to get South Africa's not especially complicated rail network functioning properly again. I suspect it's not that complicated. Somebody who knows a lot more about this than I is James Holly. James is the chief executive of a company called Traxion, T-R-A-X-T-I-O-N. It's a company which operates trains in 7 countries in other African economies, in economies where I'm guessing, James, it's much easier to get on the rails than it's proving to be in South Africa.
Evening, Bruce. Yes, well, you know, the rail reform journey outside of South Africa is also pretty recent. You know, if you go back about 6 years ago, we could only operate our trains in Mozambique. And today, you can operate our trains in almost all of our regional trading partners, and increasingly in other parts of Africa as well, including West Africa and even Egypt now. So, you know, the idea of rail reform is something that has really taken root regionally, and South Africa is following, but it's coming pretty fast, it must be said, even in South Africa.
We'll talk about South Africa in just a moment. I wonder just what has been the catalyst for this broad acceptance across most of our neighbours to allow independent operators like yourselves to use the rails of a state-owned entity, because the stuff is, I suppose, quite complicated logistically, but it's probably more complicated ideologically.
So, Bruce, effectively what's happened is that in the past, railways were dominated by monopolies. They were either state-owned, and I'm talking regionally and in South Africa, they were either dominated by state-owned monopolies or private sector monopolies operating under a concession. And that was really under a World Bank-sponsored process that was initiated about 10 to 15 years ago. And pretty much all of those monopolies have really struggled. And the move now is to what we call open access, where the state retains control over the infrastructure. And then the state can continue to operate its trains, and the state railways generally do in the areas where we operate outside of South Africa. But the private sector is invited to take up the latent slots on the network. So, you know, if we use the Durban-Johannesburg line, for example, there are about 75 slots in each direction each day for trains to utilize. Transnet uses about 15 of those. Those latent slots create a huge revenue-generating opportunity for those governments to earn access fees, or is what we call them in the railways. But you would know them when you operate on the N3 as toll fees. We pay toll fees for utilizing the latent capacity in the network, which is a huge revenue-generating opportunity for the net for the regional railway industry, of course.
And we know the problems with our rail network. We've discussed them often and extensively. We know there's a new management team at Transnet, which seems to be far more open-minded about what its role is in ensuring the sustainability of Transnet. But opening up the rail network is not up to Transnet. It's a political issue. And I suppose in the same way as the state has tried to sell off SAA and then took 3 years to then basically bail on the agreement that had happened during COVID, the state struggles to make announcements when it is so wedded to state-owned ownership of assets that are supposed to work and supposed to work in everybody's interests but are failing. Where are we in the process as you see it? Somebody who's watched this rapid evolution of change in the semi-privatization, or at least the access to state-run rail networks by private operators.
So, Bruce, it really kicked into gear in March 2022 when Cabinet approved the National Rail Policy. It was the first policy in sort of living memory, a rail policy for South Africa in sort of living memory, and really set out sweeping reforms for the way that railways should be operated in South Africa. It included the vertical separation of Transnet into three parts: infrastructure owner, infrastructure manager, and train operating companies. It set out the introduction of competition on every single railway line in South Africa, whether that's commuter rail, branch line, bulk line, core line, across the whole of the country. And it set out the devolution of PRASA into the respective metros, for example. So really sweeping changes that were approved in March 2022. But I think what's really encouraging is that since then, Cabinet has also approved the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill, which sets out the regulation to enact, amongst other things, rail policy. The Freight Logistics Roadmap and the Private Sector Participation Framework for Rail were approved by Cabinet in December last year. Both of those set out the pathway to the implementation of the reform. The National Logistics Crisis Committee has been set up. Operation Bulandlela have been set up, both of them targeting the implementation of the self-same rail reforms. And even the terms and conditions of the National Treasury Guarantee to Transnet also stipulate that the reforms need to be implemented by Transnet within a set timeline. So we have seen since March 2022, in 24 months, massive progress by government, I think driven by Bulandlela, to see the implementation of this reform. What we need to see next is two big and very important elements of the implementation of the reform. The first is the finalization of the network statement, which will set out the terms and conditions and the basis in which the private sector can start to operate trains across the length and breadth of this really massive rail network we have in South Africa. 85% of Africa's rail track sits in South Africa. On the one hand, and then on the other hand, the establishment of the private sector participation unit in the Department of Transport, which is going to oversee really important projects like the concessioning of rail infrastructure to upgrade and improve the condition of the infrastructure. Because for large sectors of our freight body, we need to see huge efficiencies in order to be able to invest into trains. So those two elements are what is bearing down on us and are going to be very important to see the successful rollout of this reform. But really, the platform has been laid.
The platform, you need a platform and you need the rails. And of course, if you don't use the stuff, it deteriorates and ultimately you lose it. And we've seen theft of infrastructure and all of that sort of stuff. Your best guess where we are in terms of a time frame, because of course, for people like yourself, you're going to have locomotives on order. You're going to need the stuff to put onto the rails. You need to know have some sort of idea as to when it's all going to play out.
Bruce, so, you know, we've got a fleet of about 65 locomotives, for example, and every single one of them is deployed into our regional trading partner. So as we stand today, aside from bringing a pilot train into South Africa, we've got nothing to offer at the moment, okay? And as far as I know, the other private sector participants are in pretty much the same position. Okay, so for rail reform, really, and it has always been about this for South Africa, the scale of South Africa is just so much bigger than and the freight body in South Africa is so much bigger. So it's always been about the investment into new trains, okay, which is brilliant for the South Africa, because most of those will be assembled here. It's really good for the South African rail industry. But the challenge is that on a best case scenario, you're looking about 24 months from the time you pay a deposit for a train it leaves that workshop and that assembly plant. And that's from the time you can pay a deposit, and that's from the time you can raise about 250 million rand for just one 50-wagon flatbed container train. So you're looking at a really massive investment of money that needs to be raised, and then a reasonably long lead time before those trains can enter into operation. So before this private sector-led reform really starts to take foot and makes a difference into South Africa, you're looking at least 2026, and that's on the train side. If you look at the PSP framework and the Freight Logistics Roadmap, it talks about the adoption of concessions over sections of rail track to upgrade the condition of those. Those are also complicated projects. If you look at the concessioning of DCT2 to ICTSI, you know, those are projects that also take 12 to 18 months to get those projects away before the investments start. But, you know, in our game, when we buy assets that have a life of 30 years. On the spec sheet, it says life of asset 30 years.
James, I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you more. I really do, because I think there's lots more to learn about this. And I'm going to ask my producers to invite you back, because we're just out of time, unfortunately. Chief Executive at Traxion, James Holly, explaining South Africa's rail network and its potential like no one I've ever heard before. Producers, get him.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
I'd love to buy noise-cancelling headphones, but they're really expensive, the good ones anyway, and the posh ones make my head hot, my ears hot. I don't like the fact that they're enclosed. Toby, however, Toby Shapshak, the chief at Stuff Studios, may have found a solution to both of my problems. That solution comes in something called the Anker Soundcore Liberty 4NC. That's a very long word for little ear poddy type things that go inside your ears and make the bad noises go away, Toby.
I know. Got to break it down. So Anker's the main brand. Soundcore is their music brand. Liberty are this range of earbuds. And this is obviously Liberty 4. NC means noise cancelling. So what you have are very good noise cancelling headphones from a great brand, which is Anker. And the best part about them, Bruce, is you'll pay around $2,000 or just under. You know, they're just really excellent value for money for what you get for what's a very good price for earbuds. You know, $3,500-$4,000 is at least what you expect to start at for high-end in-ear speakers. I mean, who knew we'd be having these kind of like serious conversations about how much money you can spend on, you know, little ears, things you can stick in your ears. But it all comes down to the quality, and that's also always got to be referenced against the value for money. So good for Anker. These Liberty 4 headsets are very, very well priced. They have noise cancelling. You know, they nestle inside your ear very nicely. You know, they've seen some considerable improvement on how they fit into your ears. The case charges wirelessly, which is not something you see in these kind of entry level headphones. That also has a USB-C port for charging, which is much faster than micro USB. So you get your value for money, and you get very good headphones, Bruce. Impressively good.
I liked your description.
We gave it 8.3 out of 10.
I liked your description of in-ear speakers, because that gives me a sense that these, you know, one gets a, you know, if you're a cheapskate and you buy cheap headphones and stuff, you're used to sort of slightly tinny quality, slightly less auspicious sound quality. But the mere fact that you are endorsing them as in-ear speakers gives me a little bit more, I don't know, optimism that these things might actually be pretty good.
I mean, we thought they were very, very good. You know, Brett Fencer, who's the editor of Stuff, he has reviewed countless hundreds of headphones in the last 10-15 years of Stuff publishing, so he really knows good audio and good products, and he was hell of impressed with them. I mean, how's this for a headline? He's also a brilliant writer and does great headlines. The headline is "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Deaf." which is
very nice.
Brilliant. He's really brilliant. And he was hell of impressed with these. He thought they were really good. I was impressed with them. I'm, you know, compared to him, I'm a Luddite. But, you know, it works. They work very well. They're very good quality and they're very good price. You know, there's another set of Anchor headphones.
We must leave it there. Toby Shapshack is the chief at Stuff Studios on The Money Show this evening. Thank you, Toby Shapshack.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show on this Monday evening. I'm Bruce Whitfield, back from a little holiday. It was lovely. It was very nice to have a little holiday. Thank you very much for allowing me to have a holiday. I'm told that Matteo kept very good care of you. And that is good to know as well as we get through our agenda this evening, which tonight, in the next half hour anyway, is all going to be about choice. The choices that we make and the sort of sense that countries can make better choices. And we'll pick up on that in just a moment. A choice that the Daily Maverick has made today is to go dark, and that is to not publish today. And that's a big decision and an important decision, because it draws attention to what happens when you don't have free media, when you don't have media that is able to do the exposés, to do the work that is necessary. And I'm constantly amazed by the temerity of people in power who believe that they can get away with criminal activity and will not be exposed. In an environment where we have a massively underfunded but a massively enthusiastic and very vibrant media, eager to expose the shenanigans and wrongdoing of those who are in power. And so tonight we'll catch up with the Daily Maverick and just find out what the thinking is behind their move today to not publish, and just what sort of signal they are sending and the warning that they are sending. Before that, though, I want to just bring you up to speed. My colleagues at Prime Media put together a really lovely, fun, behind-the-scenes video that we shot about a month ago, talking about my personal likes and dislikes and what motivates me and why I do what I do. And one of the questions was all about holidays. And I made the point that you need to spend your holiday time doing something very different from what your day-to-day is. If you simply go home and stay at home, that's lovely. And I've done those sorts of holidays. And it's nice to spend time in the place that costs you a vast amount of money, where you sleep and then go off to work again. I get that going home is quite nice. But there's also an opportunity when you do go on holiday to blow your mind. And I'm very fortunate to have a friend who has a house in a tiny medieval hilltop village in Spain. And we were allowed to use it for a couple of days last week. It was wonderful. It's a little place dotted between Bilbao in the north and Saragossa, slightly further south. It truly is the middle of nowhere. And its biggest claim to fame is that it is the birthplace of a guy called King Ferdinand II of Aragon, who married Isabella of Castile. And they went about restoring the Catholic monarchy and reclaimed power from North Africans who'd conquered most of Spain and ruled it for 700 years. From about the year 700 to 1400 and something, the Moors ruled Spain. And Isabella and Ferdinand set about restoring the Catholic monarchy, and then what ensued was a period of global colonization. It made Spain into a European powerhouse in the 16th century. And eventually, of course, you know, nothing lasts forever. It became embroiled in its own civil war in the late 1930s when fascism was incredibly fashionable. We saw the rise of Hitler in the 1930s. Mussolini had risen to power in the 1920s in Italy. And a guy called Francisco Franco used the opportunity of a civil war between 1936 and 1939 to establish a military dictatorship. And he ran that military dictatorship with an iron fist between 1939 and his own death in 1975. And here's the best bit. You wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know, other than speaking to locals, that Francisco Franco had ever existed. Because there's no sort of sign of Francisco Franco anywhere. The country's chosen to put that era of repression and isolation behind it and focus on the future. And Franco was a nasty piece of work. He really was. Massively authoritarian. He had a grip that went through all facets of Spanish life, from education to media, to being an ardent nationalist. He made sure that Spain remained isolated from the international community. It became a pariah state. Hearing any parallels of a country in this grips of fascist control over that, around that same sort of time? Well, his death in 1975 gave an opportunity for Spaniards to push back against it, and it paved the way for democratic reforms. And again, this is a very complicated thing to try and communicate, and certainly a very complicated thing to try and assimilate in just a couple of days. But there's a huge vibrancy about Spain. It's got massive infrastructure, at least in the lush green north where I was. And that infrastructure is superior to many other developed economies that I've seen. Key rail, road, digital connectivity, it's everywhere. And my 15-year-old made a great observation as we drove from Bilbao to Saragossa, off the beaten track, about how many factories there were in the middle of nowhere. And it suddenly struck me that he'd made a very smart observation, very proud. He's sort of decentralized from main cities and finding factories located next to small towns. And invariably, those small towns will benefit from the presence of a factory in town, or several factories in some cases. But the presence of those factories in outlying areas is made possible by the fact that they can get raw materials in and get their product out, either by rail or by road. And the road infrastructure is amazing. The tunnels that are borne through mountains are astonishing and plentiful. The roads are well paved and well lit and well marked. And people follow the rules because the police are quite quiet. And it's an amazing place. Very clear evidence of a green energy revolution. Miles and miles of hilltop wind power. It's also the world's biggest exporter of citrus fruit, one of the world's biggest wine exporters. It's probably one of the biggest tourism markets, certainly in Europe. It had the advantage, of course, of joining the European Union. That gave it access to economic integration. It got lots of money from the EU. That saw its expansion. But that fueled by construction and tourism in the 1990s. And although 2008 hit the Spanish economy really, really hard, they've bounced back from it. Yes, their debt levels are too high. They're sitting at 100% of GDP. But that's a global problem. And they've got huge investment in renewable energy and technology. And today it's standing out as one of the biggest economies in the EU. But I was just struck by some of the parallels that I see here, and struck by the parallels that I see in Spain, in terms of a really difficult, nasty, fractious history. A country that's chosen a growth path, and it stands to benefit all of its citizens. I think it's quite a remarkable place. Another place that where I've travelled to fairly recently that has also made smart economic choices has been Dubai. And while I was there on my last visit, I met a guy called Tom Hudson, who is an investment banker. But other than that, he's quite a nice guy. But he has written a book called Exponential Emirates, the extraordinary growth rate and growth story of the United Arab Emirates. And that, too, has got a wonderful story attached to it as well, about policymakers making strategic long-term choices, the sorts of things that I think Trevor Manuel envisaged when he headed up the National Planning Department, the NDP, the National Development Plan. It was a great document, tossed away and ignored. And as a result of that, we still sit with worsening poverty, worsening outcomes, low growth rates. Don't have that same sense of optimism I came across in Spain, certainly. And certainly with the sort of optimism that you see playing out in places like Dubai as well. We'll talk about to Tom Hudson about Dubai in a moment. But first, as someone who's made a living out of the media industry for a long time, I've seen its ups and downs, but the current down is incredibly serious. And not only in South Africa, but proper journalism really is struggling all over the world. There are huge amounts of money that go into funding misinformation, disinformation, huge amounts of money that go into gagging real journalism. And also, of course, real money going into undermining serious journalism. But also some encouraging signs, too. I saw a note from Adrian Basson at News 24 today. He put out a statement celebrating the fact that they've reached 100,000 subscribers on their paid-for platform. And I think that's impressive. I really was quite circumspect when they announced that they're going to put up a paywall. And I was wondering, South Africans who are very spoilt in terms of access to information and news and used to the free model of journalism and decided that they wouldn't want to pay for it. But 100,000 of you have. So that is a very good thing for journalism generally. The Money Show, of course, brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. The Daily Maverick took it a step further today. Daily Maverick went dark. They took a decision to not publish. The idea being to demonstrate what a world without media might look like. One of those people who's had the day off is senior Daily Maverick journalist Ray Mtlaka. And Ray, I suppose it's, you know, we can make light of it and say, oh, you were so lucky to get a day off. But it's far more serious and a big strategic call, I think, by the bosses at the Daily Maverick to say, we need to demonstrate how important we are in an environment which needs a vibrant, investigative, and strong media.
Good evening, Bruce, and to the listeners. But this is not just only about Daily Maverick. What Daily Maverick is trying to do here is to highlight the crisis that journalism finds itself in, not only in South Africa, but around the world, create awareness as well as, you know, to create create a teachable moment as well for how media functions in South Africa and how it is funded. But know that a free press is a central pillar of democracy. The Constitution actually, requires the press to be free. But with financial limitations and financial pressures, we cannot serve our constitutional mandate, that is. And we hope that this decision that we've taken as Daily Maverick created awareness and also highlighted the importance of a free press for democracy.
I remember chatting to a very senior banker the one day, and he was looking at buying an emerging, very vibrant, very exciting media business. And he was asking my views about this business. And he looked at me and went, but it's not a business. I said, of course it's a business. No, not with those margins. It's not. And the reality is that the media business has become increasingly difficult. It's become an increasingly difficult place for people who would invest money to make a return. And I think Daily Maverick has, over the years, found some very kind funders who don't necessarily expect the world's greatest return on investment, if ever, but people who understand the power and the importance of media in terms of keeping power accountable. And that, I think, is something that we often lose sight of, especially in quite a divided social media world where mass media or mainstream media is frowned upon and is seen to be less and less relevant in the lives of ordinary people.
Indeed, Bruce. And if you look at how many media outlets are funded, they are largely funded through two ways. One is advertising revenue, which in South Africa and around the world is in decline. A lot of companies are not supporting media for their own financial reasons. Maybe the economy is not doing well, and you know, media spend and advertising spend is usually the first item to be cut. And the second way would be through the subscriptions model or putting up a paywall. We at Daily Maverick have decided to not go the paywall route because we believe in public interest journalism. Journalism should be free. And you know, the situation in South Africa is quite dire, Bruce, because we have about less than 20 credible media groups in South Africa that are servicing a population of about 62 million, whereas in the US, there are over 3,000 credible media outlets or groups that are servicing a population of you know, over 300 million. So you know, and also I really want to highlight this: quality and good journalism takes time. It costs money, and you know, if it wasn't for Daily Maverick and many other media organisations in South Africa, we would not know. We wouldn't have known that a bank.
No, exactly. We all know these stories, Ray. I mean, without media in South Africa, and a very resilient media, and a tough media, and a brave media, and this is not me just talking up an industry that I'm proud to be part of, but without a media industry in South Africa, we wouldn't have known about state capture. We wouldn't have known about all of the vagaries of the shenanigans that Jacob Zuma and his cohort were getting up to. And, you know, even in the face of publication of credible information, politicians were still in denial. And after Zondo, still some remain in denial, and some voters remain in denial. It's a critically important tool for a democracy, without which democracies fail. And here's the problem, though. You know, we want investment into media, but media is not giving a return to investors. So does it become, I don't know, and users don't want to pay for it, and you don't want to charge them for it. So how then are you going to survive in this environment where, you know, I can reach an audience through Google AdWords, for example, at a considerably lower cost than putting an ad on to any sort of paid media platform in South Africa? That's the real problem, is that the entire advertising model has been really broken, I would argue.
It is broken, Bruce, and also I think another big challenge is the trust deficit. A lot of people don't trust media, and I'll be the first to admit that journalists and media organizations haven't really covered themselves in glory. They've found themselves on the wrong side of ethical behavior. But, you know, if the public wants original and quality journalism, as I said, Bruce, this it requires money to produce. And policymakers and business leaders are also not coming to the party, by the way, in supporting,
Is our language not wrong on this one? Is our language, Ray, here not wrong on this? You know, you must support us, otherwise the country will go to the dogs. I find it an annoying turn of phrase, simply because nobody's got a right to exist. If you're running a business, you must have a compelling business model. And it's time to reinvigorate the business model. Is this the first sign from Daily Maverick that you are going to start charging? Because unless you start charging, I'm not too sure whether or not there is going to be a business model that is going to sustain you, is there?
Yeah. Well, we believe that, you know, if you offer quality journalism, then people will see the value in it. But, Bruce, it goes back to my point, what I said. We believe that, you know, again, journalism should serve the public, and we should offer, and journalism should be a tool for public interest. And, exploring a paywall, this is something that me and my colleagues don't believe in at the moment. But the only way to sustain journalism at the moment is to offer readers original and quality journalism. That's what we believe in.
Ray Mtlaka, and unfortunately with that is a huge cost, because gathering information, believe it or not, takes time, and it takes money, and it takes a very high level of expertise, and the Daily Maverick does a fantastic job at it, and the guys at News24 do a fantastic job at it, and journalists generally are doing a fantastic job. Yes, I'm journalists, so not journalists, they're not allowed to say those words on the radio, but yes, Ray Mtlaka, thank you very much. Yeah, Daily Maverick going dark for the day.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
Business books.
I was recently in Dubai and got to meet a man called Tom Hudson. Tom has been in Dubai for nearly 20 years. He took a decision to write a book about Dubai because something extraordinary has happened, not only in Dubai, but in the United Arab Emirates generally. And that has been this extraordinary growth story. And for the last 50 years, there's been a growth story that's been very much in place. And Tom Hudson has taken a very interesting way of cataloguing it. 50 interviews. 50 key people representing a whole group of Emiratis and expats, all sorts of people, including the British-born founder of the very successful Emirates Airline and many others, including from the royal family, and really has put together, I think, a very interesting take on the power of long-term decision-making and the power of intense focus and the power of strategic opportunism in an area which really, you know, 50 years ago, was little more than desert sand with a couple of oil rigs. I don't mean to undermine the United Arab Emirates at all here, Tom, but really the growth story of the UAE and Dubai, where you are based in particular, has been nothing short of a strategic, I don't want to call it a miracle because it's been deliberate, but certainly a strategic miracle may be the appropriate way of putting it.
Yeah, exactly. And thank you for having me on and giving me the chance to talk about, as you say, the extraordinary growth story of the UAE. And you hit the nail on the head. There's been a plan. And 2021 saw the 50th anniversary of the UAE. So the UAE was established in 1971. That's when His Highness Sheikh Zayed, the founder of the UAE, went around and united the Emirates. And again, in those early days, there was no guarantee of success. But actually reinvesting the oil money and putting in a plan got us to 2021. And the UAE hosted the World Expo, which for me really summarized and encapsulated the 50-year story. And I was talking to the executive office of Sheikh Mohammed, ruler of Dubai, to say, How can we tell this story wider? And they very kindly encouraged me to write this book, where I interviewed 50 people that had all been part of that amazing growth story. And as you say, there's a plan, and there's actually a centennial plan. So 2071, which will be the 100th anniversary of the UAE, there is a published plan as to what they think the UAE will look like then. And there are people actively working towards making that vision a reality. So for me, that, you know, comes from the UK, where often one isn't sure of a one-year plan, let alone a 50-year plan. It's actually great that people in a country can think long-term and actually plant those seeds and know that they will be sort of germinated and grow over the years to come.
But there was a realization 50 years ago, maybe a little more than 50 years ago, that the oil economy wasn't going to last forever. Either the world would run out of fossil fuels or the world would run out of, you know, time for pollution associated with fossil fuels. And we're kind of reaching that apex now where it was a COP28, I beg your pardon, and, you know, stopping short of banning fossil fuels but promising to use fewer fossil fuels over longer periods of time was a commitment that came out of Dubai, out of COP28, and seemed to be quite revolutionary. This was a part of the world which could look to the future and didn't put blinkers on or close its eyes to the future, but said, look, there are realities we have to face, so we have to fundamentally shift our own business model. We cannot depend on fossil fuels in perpetuity, and that's precisely what they did.
Exactly. And actually, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, current president of the UAE, went further and said that he would celebrate the last barrel of oil, which I think is pretty extraordinary. And what he meant was that by then they would have had to have reinvested in the future. And so energy transition has been a big part of that. And, you know, the UAE came in for some criticism for hosting COP28. But actually, I think getting the UAE to host it and to put their money quite literally where their mouth was, to say that we are going to invest in the future. And actually, energy transition isn't something new. They had begun Masdar City, for example, in the past. And I actually interviewed His Excellency Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber, who is head of ADNOC, the National Oil Company for Abu Dhabi, but also was president of COP. And so he was really behind the steering wheel of everything. He spoke to everyone. He'd actually been going to COPs for the last 15 years and was actually able to create the COP consensus that happened and got everyone to agree to that transition. And he was behind Masdar City, which is this city that is about the future of energy, solar-powered, autonomous vehicles, using you know, batteries, electric vehicles. It's extraordinary to witness and also to see experiments with hydrogen, with nuclear, and to be really at the cutting edge of that.
It's been nothing short of an extraordinary growth story. And there's a level of confidence within the Emirates, which is one that says, you know, we are riding the on the backs of those who have, you know, created the strategic framework before us. There's a huge amount of confidence that they can keep going for the next 50 years, although we know no empire is certain and no empire lasts forever. But they've taken a very clear, and there was a wonderful simple sort of phraseology that they used, from seaport to airport, I think to brainport is the term, if I've got it right. And this thing about really evolving faster than the global environment, perhaps, and putting yourself at the center of the world, not only geographically, but doing it from a leadership point of view and a thought process point of view.
Yeah, that was a quote from His Excellency Abdullah bin Talq Al Mahri, who is head of or minister of economy. And he charted that, you know, the origins of the UAE far before it was the UAE, was a place, was a seaport where people would stop off en route from west to east. And then, of course, with the airports, with Emirates, with Etihad, it brought a new generation of traveler. And I think that move to brainport, when other countries are closing the doors to immigrants, the UAE calls immigrants calls us expats, and we are part of its future, and we are encouraged to bring our families to the UAE, to educate our families there. And I think that melting pot from all around the world is really taking note, and people are coming now to the UAE to find talent pools, because, you know, a quarter of the world lives within a four-hour flight, and I think two-thirds of the world live within an eight-hour flight of the UAE. So really, really putting that that sort of hub model together and into practice, you're really seeing that come to fruition.
Tom Hudson, thanks so much for joining us this evening. He's the managing partner of Kestrel Global in the United Emirates, but he was also the author of a book called Exponential Emirates, The Extraordinary Story of the UAE. And it is an astonishing story. It's by no means perfect. Not everybody likes it. It is not a place of great personal freedoms. Certainly you can criticize its structure and the way in which it runs, but what you can learn from it is, with planning, in the same way as Spain has learned following its period of fascism, that when you open yourself up and you start thinking strategically about the future and you start planning for that future and you have the right people in the right place at the right time doing the right things, ultimately you can create economic miracles. And Dubai is evidence that truly... I recently saw that well-known luxury watch retailer has raised some outside funding. And I thought, why would luxury time in a tough economy be raising money? And who'd be giving money to a company that makes its money selling secondhand goods and selling secondhand goods into a market that surely itself is struggling? That was one question. The other, how do you make a living out of selling posh pre-owned watches? Our guest this evening on How I Make Money is Adrian Rutman, who's been doing this for 19 years and counting. What is your fascination, Adrian, with posh watches, expensive watches, luxury watches? What term do you prefer?
I'd call them luxury watches, Bruce. But I suppose you can call them luxury toys or, it's collectibles for some guys. What fascinated me about watches is I just started watches from a young age. I always remembered looking at my dad's watch. I think he had like a Seiko or some pretty low-end watch at that time that he was admired.
We all had a Seiko at some, or a Seiko, because a Seiko is something completely different. At some point. I liked my Seiko. I liked some Seikos too, but that's a different story. Absolutely. So, but again, Seikos were inexpensive, but yeah, there were some pretty attractive ones. And was that the beginning of the
situation? It's more about the look of the watch that fascinated me more than the brand. I didn't really know a lot about brands when I was still young, so it was purely the look of it. As I grew older, then I could appreciate the value in the watches, and then I started following the brands. And you know, some brands has investment quality, others is just purely outrageous watches that are just horological masterpieces that the watchmaker just took time to make and just for people to enjoy. That's not really assets or something that will appreciate in value, but just purely the beauty of the watches.
Yeah, absolutely. And what makes one watch more expensive than another? Because ultimately they have a function, and that function is to tell time. That function is to say it is now, and look at my phone, and I look at my computer, and my computer tells me it's 1943. My phone tells me it's 1943, which means 17 minutes before 8 o'clock and 17 minutes before the money show ends. Those clocks have served a purpose. This is not about the function of time telling, although the mechanisms that are created in some of these things are amongst some of the most precise instruments on earth.
Yeah, believe it or not, an automatic watch is actually not as precise as a quartz watch would be. So,
really?
It is definitely not 100% accurate time, but it's not about, as you just mentioned, it's not about the, it's not about telling the time. A watch is to tell the time, but really these kind of watches that people are moving to, the investment kind of watches, the very high end luxury watches, it's more of status symbols, I'd say. People, if you walk into a boardroom and you have a nice watch on, people around you, they do take you a little bit seriously, or I don't know, it's something to express yourself, but not in a loud way. You obviously get the blingy watches with diamonds and golds, and if you walk into a room, everyone's going to notice it. But it's more about, you know, you get 2, 3, 4 million rand watches that looks like if it comes from a lucky packet, so people won't really know it.
Yep.
But the guys that do know, they know, and it just gives the right impression.
And well, it depends on your perspective, doesn't it? I mean, yes, you can. I quite like really understated, good quality watches. I'm a fan of the Cartier Tank, for example. It's highly classic. It's the design. I don't know if it's evolved at all since the Tank was created, for example. And I cannot, for the love or money, imagine ever wearing a Breitling. It's tatty. It's nasty. And you know, the origins of Breitling are very good in aviation and everything else, but really, I cannot be a fan of the ostentatious nature and the sorts of people who wear them, because I just don't like them. And they give the brand a bad sort of association as well.
Yeah, their watches, they did start off, or they are probably known as big, chunky watches. But I mean, if you go into the history of it, the brand also has Very classical watches like the Navy Timers series. But if you go the Super Avengers, the Breitling Emergencies, they're all massive watches. But to come back to your point about watches being ostentatious, or you say Breitling, you don't like it, but I mean each person,
of course,
you go for a certain brand. Like you maybe hate Breitling, but you're a Cartier guy, like you said. Maybe your wife
I'm not a Cartier guy.
Long jeans.
I wish I was a Cartier guy. If I had the opportunity to spend money on a watch that, you know, I was, you know, going to wear on special occasions, that would be my personal preference. But yes, I'm not a Cartier guy, because you've got to own a Cartier.
Yeah, because it expresses your personality in some sort of way.
Yeah. But your fascination, I mean, it goes from a fascination into building a business. And how did you turn that fascination into a business? Because clearly, I mean, there are a million different styles, and there are different appetites, and also different values, I suppose, and prices you can achieve for watches, and access to different models of watches, and, you know, finding these things and sourcing them for your customers. How did it all play out?
I went to play a bit of cricket overseas in the UK when I was young and I just left school. I stopped in Dubai. I saw a watch there that I actually purchased for my mom back then. This was probably 18 years ago. I purchased the watch for like 700 rand. Came to South Africa. I saw the exact same watch in the Menland shopping mall. It was selling for 3,000 rand. And I always had this entrepreneurial thing where I bought stuff and sold stuff, whether it was my grandmother's vacuum cleaners, trying to go sell that somewhere, or cigarettes from my dad that I took. I went to Pick and Pay and bought a six pack of cigarettes and then sell it to them when they're on holiday. So I always wanted to sell stuff. So, and then I just saw the big margins that there is on watches, and I also loved watches. And then I started researching, and I saw there was not, that was also probably the start of the internet in South Africa. It wasn't big online sales, and especially selling high-end valuables online was like non-existent. So then I started the website Luxury Time. I didn't have one watch in stock. So basically what I did, I just went on to overseas websites, copied all their stock that they had, listed it on a website, pretend as if I had the watches in stock, but I never had the watches. And as I got inquiries, then I would go to jewelry stores here in South Africa and tell them, listen, I'm selling watches, but I'm doing it online. That was when, like, there was a big thing against, they never said you can actually buy authentic watches online. But that's how you build the credibility over the business. But then, as I said, I went to the stores. Eventually, the stores gave me some watches to sell as I got orders through the website. And it just eventually, it snowballed over time, where 15 years ago, every single call we would get first was, how do I know you're legit? How do I know it's authentic? All those kind of questions. And fast forward 16, 17 years, we don't get those questions anymore. People are comfortable to sit at their houses, shop online, spend 500,000 or million rand without even seeing a watch, buying it online, and just thought that it's going to arrive at their doorstep the next day. But it does arrive for them. But that's how we have built credibility over the years in the brand.
Was there an aversion to the retail store selling secondhand watches? Because the last thing you want to do, I suppose, is create competition for your main business, which is the sale of new watches, which the margins are vast in these things. And of course, these are brands that are venerable brands that have been built over centuries in some cases. Did they just not want to be traders in the secondhand market? They were happy for you to have that market?
No, my business actually started as a only selling brand new unworn watches. So I was listing all these watches on the website and getting them brand new unworn from the stores and then selling them on. But the margins is pretty slim. You know, I was only getting the kind of discounts, or maybe a little bit more because I was buying a lot. But if they would, example, give a client 20% discount, I would maybe get 30% because I was buying five or 10 watches at a time. So then as the all my clients were starting to buy the new watches, maybe they were wearing them for two or three years, then they would come back to me and say, Adrian, I want to buy another watch, but what can I do with my old one? Don't you want to buy it back? And then that's how that business ignited, is by trading back the pre-owned stuff, refurbishing it, and then selling it again to the next clients. And the margins in that is much bigger than, I'd say, selling new watches.
It's interesting, and you're not going to like this story, but I must tell it anyway. Kevin Lings is a well-known economist, and he's got a side hustle, and it's more of a hobby than a hustle. And he takes great pride in sourcing the authentic original components that are used by the big watch brands, the casings, everything. And he goes and builds watches. And at the time I chatted to him about this, which is a long time ago, 6 or 7 years ago, I remember him saying that he could build an Omega watch that was being advertised probably by George Clooney at the time, or one of the James Bonds at the time, probably Daniel Craig. I think he wears Omega in the movies. And that particular watch was going for 70,000 Rand. Kevin Lings could source all of the components, authentic components, for about 10,000 Rand. And he would go online in this big, deep nerd fest. And then he would sit at home with his little eyepiece thingy, I don't know what that thing's called, and painstakingly build these watches as a horologist would do. The only difference between the watch that he put his own name on it, the Lings watch, while it was, to all intents and purposes, exactly the same sort of thing that was on the shop shelf, it had cost him a fraction of the price to build it than it was on sale for retail. And that's the power of brands, I suppose. If you're going to want to own a Cartier or a Montblanc watch, if you want to do that sort of thing, or you want to have a Breitling, or you want to have any one of the other myriad of watch brands, the branding and the cultivation of those brands over long periods of time, I think, have actually turned this into quite an interesting sector in which to trade and to play, as you found.
Yeah, definitely. So you're saying the guy that one of your friends or that you interviewed, he didn't name the watches Omega. He put his own name on the
brand. No. He put his own name. So his friends would know that this was exactly the same thing, to all intents and purposes. It just didn't have the Omega brand on it. And he took great joy. And because he's an economist, he understands these things. He understands supply chains, and he understands margins. But, you know, the cost of building these things isn't all that expensive. But the price of having it on your arm.
No, that's what I wanted. Yeah, that's because you're buying into the brand, into the history. But that's exactly what you said. Although he built his own brand, and just to show you what he was actually trying to explain to you is the cost of that watch. It's pretty much the same conversation I also often have with clients. The amount of fake watches that is out on the market that is such good replicas compared to authentic one. And if you think you can buy a super replica for around about 20,000 Rand, that is pretty much indistinguishable from the real one to the untrained eye. That just tells you like how they sell one Rolex watch, let's say the Daytona, which sells on the gray market, the steel one, for plus minus 500 to 600,000 Rand. You can buy that exact replica for around about 20,000 Rand. So, as you said, I wonder what the actual cost is of making that.
How do you protect yourself?
Sorry, Bruce, I lost you there.
For whatever reason, the digital gods are not on our side this evening. What a pity that is. But yes, you can find out a bit more about him online. You certainly will find the original story from about November last year, all about his new funding. But a fascinating world of watches, watch trading, watch buying. And, you know, I was a bit rude about Breitling. Sorry, Breitling. It's not my taste. And the sort of people that you sell your watches to. Not my taste, but that's just me. Each one of these has got a market, otherwise they wouldn't exist. And you certainly, I have... I like to hang around hardware stores. I don't buy very much in hardware stores, but I like to think that if I hang around maybe by osmosis, I'll develop DIY skills in the same way as I will look at the Wanted magazine and flick through the watch pages and look at the watch adverts, because watch advertising is a thing of great beauty. It is a thing of great beauty. Patek Philippe has still got the best watch payoff line of all time. And it's something along the lines of, you don't own a Patek Philippe. You are its custodian for the next generation, or something like that. And they've created this wonderful mystique around a mechanism that simply tells the time. It doesn't make tea. It doesn't wake you up in the morning. It doesn't give you a massage. It just tells the time. But it also gives you a certain status and a certain elevation in certain societies, or makes people think that you're an ostentatious waste of space. That's the other side of some watch brands anyway. Thank you to Adrian Ruttmann, who is the founder of Luxury Time on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield was brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you award-winning trade and working capital funding solutions to unlock the full potential of your business story. APSA is a registered FSP.